it's good timing, and it's fair and honest to Alaskans to let them know that this is the intention, is to keep working hard for Alaska in different paths.
Governor Palin makes an official public appearance in Kotzebue. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Tuesday, the 7th of July. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, the Coast Guard reports to Congress on its Arctic operations.
We are learning valuable lessons about what operates up there well and what doesn't, and what can support operations and what can't.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. The U.S. Bankruptcy Court for the District of Oregon has set a deadline for filing claims for anyone who suffered injury by sexual, mental, or physical abuse or misconduct by a Jesuit priest or others claiming the Society of Jesus Oregon Providence has some responsibility. The deadline is November 30, 2009. Proof of claim forms are available online or by calling 1-888-909-0100. This message is sponsored by the Society of Jesus Oregon Providence.
Sarah Palin returned to work as Alaska's governor today in Kotzebue. She visited the Arctic community to sign a bill aimed at strengthening the Village Public Safety Officer program. It was her first official public appearance as governor since she announced her plan to resign. The bill is intended to free up funding to introduce more VPSOs to more villages. In her speech, Palin stressed the importance of VPSOs and credited Kotzebue Representative Reggie Jewell for introducing the legislation.
It was good pieces of a puzzle that came together on this legislation with Representative Jewell. You know, his heart and his passion is right here, serving the people of this region. He's a great representative for this region. And then Joe Masters, our new commissioner of public safety, he knew too. We needed to beef up the tools needed for a stronger VPSO program. So all the folks working together on this legislation allowed it to come to fruition, and it will be good for this region.
Palin arrived in Kotzebue from Dillingham, where she spent the last day fishing with her family. After the bill signing ceremony, Palin addressed the issue that's on everyone's minds, her abrupt decision to resign. She didn't say anything to clarify her reasons for leaving state office, but told KOTZ Radio her family intends to stay in Alaska.
Alaska is our home, and we'll just be able to work with and for others who can help progress the state and others who want to serve in or out of office. I don't believe that I need a title to affect the change that's still needed in the state. So that's where we're going. As I make this decision in my final year of office, it's good timing for others to start lining up for other candidates, what they want to do and how the race will unfold in this next year. It's good timing, and it's fair and honest to Alaskans to let them know that this is the intention, is to keep working hard for Alaska in different paths.
Palin's early departure from the governor's office is creating political opportunity for others who would like to be the state's next chief executive. Nearly a dozen people already have filed letters of intent with the Alaska Public Offices Commission to run in 2010. The list includes State Senator Hollis French, a Democrat from Anchorage, and longtime Representative John Harris, a Republican from Valdez. Patty Higgins, chairwoman of the Alaska Democratic Party, says former Representative Ethan Berkowitz, a Democrat from Anchorage, will enter the fray in the fall. Higgins says Alaskans are tired of the drama and want a governor who will finish the job. Fish as well as people are expected to benefit from another round of federal stimulus funding that's headed to Alaska. Coast Alaska's Ed Schoenfeld reports.
The National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration plans to spend about $3.5 million on fisheries habitat projects in Southeast, the Kenai Peninsula, and Cordova. Another $1 million will fund statewide marine debris cleanup. Southeast's project will help restore salmon habitat along the Klawak River near Craig on Prince of Wales Island. About $1 million will be spent building a large concrete culvert in a causeway next to the Klawak River estuary. Norm Cohen works for the Nature Conservancy, which won funding for the work.
This project is to open up a portion of that causeway so that there can be fish passage and open up that habitat to salmon, both on their out-migration, their rearing, and their in-migration.
The work will help restore one of two channels connecting the river to the ocean. Erica Ammon of the NOAA Restoration Center says it will allow young salmon to stop in an area full of eelgrass before heading into the ocean.
they go through a period where they have been reared in fresh water and they need to go out to the ocean. And they go through a process called osmoregulation, where they need to get used to the salt water and the salinity in the environment. And that's where the estuaries are very important, because it's not as salty as the ocean, but it is not complete fresh water. And so it gives them a greater chance of survival.
The project is expected to create about a dozen jobs during construction, which will take place next year. The Kluwak Watershed Council is also contributing funds. The U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, the Forest Service, Ducks Unlimited, and the Alaska Trollers Association are also involved. Marine debris cleanup efforts funded by NOAA cover coastal areas from Craig to Little Diomede Island in the Bering Strait. David Benton heads up the Marine Conservation Alliance Foundation, which will oversee the work.
The bigger project is removing a derelict vessel at St. Paul Island, getting it off the beach down by the First Seal Rookeries in southeast. We've got a community project in Craig being organized by a woman down there with a bunch of volunteers and some paid folks to clean up beaches around Craig. We got folks out of Sitka going over to clean up Bjorka Island. We've got an ongoing project out in Yakutat that's going to help fund some additional expanded work. So it's quite a program.
The work will take place this year and next. It will employ about 125 people, mostly village residents, in projects lasting from a few weeks to a month. Benton says the work is in addition to the foundation's other cleanup efforts.
We like to concentrate on derelict fishing gear and the stuff that is having probably the largest impact, immediate impact on fish and wildlife and marine environment. But, you know, when we get people out on beaches, they pick up whatever they find there and try and get rid of it. So, you know, it can be everything from plastic water bottles to cargo netting and fishing lines, whatever.
Two other stimulus fisheries efforts were funded by NOAA. $1 million Copper River Watershed Project will open more than a mile of river habitat and improve circulation to Eyak Lake near Cordova. $1.5 million Kenai Watershed Forum Project will restore a stream near Moose Pass. The four Alaska projects are among 50 nationwide that are receiving $167 million of stimulus funds through NOAA. This is Ed Schoenfeld in Juneau.
The Shanta Creek fire burning north of Tustamina Lake in the Kenai National Wildlife Refuge continues to grow. Wildlife officials are monitoring the blaze, which was started by lightning about a week ago. Refuge manager Robin West said this afternoon that the fire grew by a couple thousand acres on Monday.
Burning up the both live and dead spruce. There's a lot of beetle kill spruce in there, and it's burning live spruce too, but it's not really spotting, or, you know, it's just a kind of a steady growth to the primarily to the east. And at noon today, we had it mapped to 2,341 acres, plus or minus.
West says as long as the fire continues to burn away from civilization, as it has been doing, there's no reason to try to put it out. Wildfire officials have developed a contingency plan in case that happens. West says some areas touched by the fire haven't been burned in over 100 years.
There's a wetland section to the north of Fox Lake that it kind of went around, which is an area that the last time that burned was, in our estimation, 1871.
West says they expect warm, dry conditions to persist on the Kenai Peninsula for the foreseeable future. That means the fire will likely continue to grow. Once it is out, he says the burned area should be good habitat for a variety of wildlife, such as moose and hare. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, Alaskan cargo that never makes it to the state.
There's something like 100 million cargo containers that are shipped overseas every year, and something like 2,000 to 10,000 of them go overboard.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Penn Air, providing scheduled service to 36 communities throughout Southwest Alaska. Reservations online at pennair.com. And by the UAF College of Engineering and Mines, providing early registration for fall engineering classes at 1-877-474-7390. Information at uaf.edu/cem.
The commandant of the U.S. Coast Guard says the nation should beef up its presence in the Arctic. Admiral Thad Allen made his comments in Washington today before a Senate Commerce Subcommittee hearing about Coast Guard oversight. Alaska Senator Mark Begich and others questioned him about what is needed in the Arctic for protection and exploration. Allen said one major gap is in the nation's icebreaker fleet. The U.S. currently has 3 compared to Canada's 13 and Russia's approximately 20. Of the American vessels, one is docked for repairs, another is more than 30 years old, and the third is small and designed mostly for scientific research. Under questioning from Senator Begich, Allen said the American presence needs to be stronger.
What we have right now, in my view, is a minimum capability we need to be able to respond if all 3 of them are operating, and they are not.
They are not. So that's the biggest challenge right there.
Begich and Allen agreed ideally there would be 4 or 5 Arctic icebreakers so a trio can be in operation at all times. One ship costs about $900 million to build. Admiral Allen recommended funding repairs to the docked icebreaker, the Polar Star, and then moving the operational budget for icebreakers back to the Coast Guard from the National Science Foundation. It was moved 2 years ago, but the NSF has agreed that it can go back to the Coast Guard, given the emerging focus on defense and safety operations as the Arctic melts and opens up. Allen also recommended doing an assessment of icebreakers to decide whether to keep repairing the ones currently in operation or replace them. Besides the presence of icebreakers, Allen says the Coast Guard is exploring what other equipment can be used in the far north. He says for the third summer, they've moved up vessels and equipment to see how it functions in the Arctic's open waters as the ice cap recedes. The Coast Guard has sent up small boats, helicopters, buoy tenders, and large cutters. Allen admits that mostly the research has shown what doesn't work.
We are learning valuable lessons about what operates up there well and what doesn't, and what can support operations and what can't. We know that we are challenged with small boat operations because the ability to launch them in the vicinity of Point Barrow, and maybe need to look at an alternative such as an airboat that we use on the Great Lakes and in the ice season.
Allen says the unpredictable cold weather makes for an added difficulty, and helicopters are challenged by the lack of navigation and communications command and control infrastructure so far north. He says any ship off the North Slope, even one traveling in open water, should have an ice-strengthened hull, because if the wind blows steadily, it can pack ice together. The Coast Guard is currently doing a major analysis of its needs in the Arctic and how they're changing as more passageways open up.
We're in the process of doing a high latitude study, and later on this year we hope to develop a mission analysis for what exactly the requirements are to operate up there and what capabilities would meet it. There is not quite a match right now, one for one, on what we have, but we are taking what we have and moving it up there in the summer to try and achieve an effect.
There is not funding for repairs to the Polar Star icebreaker included in the latest budget, but Allen said that's likely because of a condensed budgeting process done as the administration changed over. He noted that there is funding for repairs in a Senate appropriations bill. A little more than a week ago, 3 cargo containers went overboard on their way through Milbank Sound off the coast of British Columbia. 2 of the containers are still missing, but the loss could make for some interesting beachcombing. KCAW's Emily Schwing has more.
On a normal sailing from Seattle to Southeast, 3 40-foot containers bound for Ketchikan never arrived. The tug Kirsten H. was towing the barge Hunter Bay when weather turned ugly and seas got rough. Sean Richardson is the operations manager for Northland Services in Southeast Alaska.
I mean, we've not lost anything before this. It's a rare event. We've not had any cargo losses ourselves, and so this is the first time for us in Southeast Alaska here.
Richardson says the area is among a handful of rough spots on this particular route.
Maritime people are very knowledgeable about Milbank Sound and the difficulties in crossing it during severe weather or concerned weather. Dixon Entrance is a very possible place for something like that to happen, although it's not as exposed to the open ocean. And then south of Chatham Straits, I should say, that's another area that's very exposed to the weather.
2 of the containers were filled with miscellaneous items for local Southeast businesses. The third was a refrigerator container filled with 40,000 pounds of salt headed for a cold storage facility. Of the 3 containers that went overboard, only one has been recovered.
On a worldwide basis, there's
something like 100 million cargo containers that are shipped overseas every year, and something like 2,000 to 10,000 of them go overboard.
That's oceanographer Curtis Ebbesmeyer.
One container going overboard with, say, plastic shopping bags, that's 5 million shopping bags out in the Pacific. That's way more than the total amount of sea turtles out there. So one container can be catastrophic. So it's a lot of times not so much a matter of the number of containers, but what's in them.
Ebbesmeyer is well known for his work focusing on what floats on the surface of the ocean.
Because it's an oceanographic blind spot, what's floating on the ocean is unexplored in oceanography. Oceanographers put their equipment down deeper, but what's actually floating at the sea surface can't be seen from ships, can't be seen from satellites. It's just really invisible. And the only people that really see it are beachcombers. And I'm the first person to really organize beachcombers and really study what floats on the surface.
What's the most interesting thing that you've found on a beach?
I have to say it would be a skeleton in a survival suit. You know, that was in Hawaii. As far as I know, the mariner, who still remains unknown, fell overboard in the Arctic Ocean and drifted for 2 years. Not unusual your way for a ship to come to grief and people go overboard and they get in their survival suit. The good news is they got in the survival suit. The bad news is they may never be found.
Ebbesmeyer has found everything from rubber ducks to shoes on beaches all over the world. He says it took him a while, but he finally found a pair of footwear that came within half a size of his own shoes.
A number of people have come within a half a size, and that's close enough because most people's feet are different by half a size anyway, so... If you get within half a size, you're doing pretty good. What I try to do is I try to leave my curiosity wide open. What's floating on the ocean is unknown. It defies the imagination. So if you try to make a checklist, it's going to rein in your imagination. You really have to look without bias and say, gee, it's not on my checklist, but I'm going to. That's interesting anyway. There's thousands and thousands and thousands of kinds of things that are out there, and most of them are unknown. It seems like it should be totally known, but it's not. What's floating on the ocean is unexplored.
Whether or not the miscellaneous items in the Northland Services containers will ever be found is unknown, but perhaps a little beach combing in Southeast will turn up something. In Sitka, I'm Emily Schwing.
The state's Geological and Geophysical Survey has released new mining data for the Chistochina District. Melanie Worden, who is a section chief for the division, says the information from airborne surveys of 442 square miles of the district is meant to provide data about the region's bedrock, the types of rocks in the area, and their electric and magnetic properties. The information is free to the public and can be used in a variety of ways.
We're also doing a neotectonic study, which is important for understanding the Denali Fault system, and that may help us know more about, you know, what it can tell us about that fault system so we could understand earthquakes and faults in interior Alaska better.
The mining district touches the Denali Fault. Worden says about 182,000 troy ounces of placer gold have been taken from the district. She says there is likely more gold out there and someone wants to find it.
It's more the companies that are interested in exploring for the lode gold instead of the placer gold. And that's the lode gold is that that's trapped inside the rocks themselves. It hasn't been put down into the streams.
The information is available on printed map sheets and in digital form.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by the Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, operating and maintaining the Trans-Alaska Pipeline, and by Alaska Communication Systems, converging voice, video, internet, and data applications for business with data transfer speeds up to Gig E. ACS, connecting Alaska companies to each other and the rest of the world.
Two arts organizations have purchased the former Fireside Building in downtown Ketchikan. As KRBD's Deanna Garrison reports, the purchase is a major milestone in a multi-year effort to find a permanent home for the First City Players and Ketchikan Theater Ballet.
On Tuesday, the two arts groups finalized the purchase of the 21,000-square-foot Fireside building from First Bank for $350,000 less than the $1.1 million price tag. Lilette Kistler is the co-chair of the Performing Arts Center Committee.
We purchased the building for $750,000, which was a steal. I have to give credit to First Bank. It was actually appraised at, I can't remember, $1.2 million or something like that, and they gave it to us for $750,000 kind of as a donation. And so First Bank was really instrumental in allowing us to get this building.
The arts groups were able to purchase the building through grants from the Ketchikan Gateway Borough and City of Ketchikan. $500,000 came from the borough share of the state cruise ship head tax money.
Putting bathrooms in there for visitors so that the cruise ship funds could help pay for just that seed money for the building.
Kistler says the groups will need to come up with an estimated $5 million to renovate the Fireside. Most of that money would come from potential grants from foundations as well as a $500,000 local capital campaign. Up until relatively recently, the Arts Council, First City Players, and Ketchikan Theater Ballet were seeking to construct an art center for all three organizations. The effort resulted in a public vote on the project in 2006. Voters that fall rejected a $12 million general obligation bond proposition for the renovation of the former White Cliff School, which would have been converted into an arts and senior center. The Arts Council has since purchased and is in the process of renovating a building on Main Street across the street from the planned First City Players and Ketchikan Theater Ballet Arts Center. First City Players Board President Tom LeCombe says the process of securing a permanent building has been long, but a worthwhile endeavor.
With the two oldest arts organizations in the community, Ketchikan Theater Ballet at 48 years old and First City Players at 44 years old, it's the culmination of a long-time, lifetime dream to have a home of our own, if you will. It's been really a 10-year quest.
The three-story building would include a 200-seat theater, offices, four rehearsal studios, and storage space, which LeCombe says is at a premium for both arts groups.
Right now, First City Players and KTB have costumes and things stored all over the borough, out at the pulp mill site. We've had them in people's garages, in some spaces in the First Bank building. So we will be able to collectivize all of our set stuff. We'll have a scene shop there. There'll be a freight elevator to go from the basement up to the third floor.
LeCombe says it will likely be a year or two before the two groups could move into the building. In Ketchikan, I'm Deanna Garrison.
Sitkins can now update Facebook from the lawn at Totem Square. Last month, the city launched a public internet program, and soon free wireless will be available in downtown Sitka from Pioneer Square to Crescent Harbor. KCAW's Shalise Haas reports.
City systems analyst Jim DeGennaro is busy installing repeaters in shop windows throughout the city. Over the next couple of weeks, he's hoping to make downtown Sitka one big wireless hotspot. But don't cancel your DSL service just yet. DeGennaro says the city system isn't intended for robust internet use, and the bandwidth has been limited to avoid competition with private internet providers.
It is intended for the small handheld devices and for some limited use with laptops. It is much better than dial-up, but not nearly as good as a broadband connection. But it's very good for just casual browsing of the internet, purchasing Facebook. It would work just fine.
The signal is also weaker inside buildings, and because it's a shared network, the connection speed is likely to slow at peak hours. But the service is free and accessible to anyone. The equipment and initial service contract cost the city approximately $10,000 and was paid for with money from the cruise ship head tax. DeGennaro says the network was intended primarily as a convenience for visitors, but he expects the city will find a way to maintain the service year-round.
With the funding for the cruise ships, that's only being funded for activity during the cruise ship season. So someone will have to pick up the extra $200 a month for the six-month off season. So the initial expense is the big thing, and it's only a couple hundred dollars a month to supply the ongoing internet service. It makes sense to keep it running.
At the moment, coverage is limited, but DeGennaro will be placing nearly 30 devices throughout the downtown area over the next few weeks. The repeaters are small white boxes that could fit in your pocket. But DeGennaro says, don't try it. He's put special stickers on the back of each repeater.
They say, this device provides for Wi-Fi internet for our visitors. This device will only work with the city system. And this device will automatically report its location if it's turned on. So that's hopefully to make sure they don't disappear and go into people's homes. Because I will find out, oh, they're at somebody's house and I can go investigate it. So it's really not something that you'd want to take.
Public wireless has been available in Centennial Hall, City Hall, and the Kettleson Library for almost 2 years. Jerry Von Rakowski is the Technical Services Director for the library. She says that since the library went wireless in 2007, they've been inundated with web surfers. On a busy day, staff have a hard time finding places for people to sit. And she says the number of wireless users can double or triple on cruise ship days. Von Rakowski doesn't expect the library traffic to slow now that the city's wireless program has expanded. She says that even when there's only room to sit on the floor, most days it's still more comfortable than sitting outside. In Sitka, I'm Shalice Haas.
The Alaska Federation of Natives is partnering with the National Congress of American Indians to sponsor an essay contest open to all Native thinkers. The theme is Native Insight, thoughts on recession, recovery, and opportunity. Writers can choose from one of three prompts, all that ask what the Native community can do to help rebuild the economy. Erin Fogg, Alaska Federation of Natives spokeswoman for the contest, says it's about giving Natives a voice in the recovery discussion.
There are a lot of different ideas out there about how we should go about sort of putting the United States back on track. And oftentimes Native communities are not heard as they should be. So the idea here is to give people across the U.S. the opportunity to write in. You know, it doesn't matter what their grammar looks like. We're looking for just good ideas that we can help sort of amplify a little bit and get out there.
The winners of the contest will each get a $10,000 prize, the money coming from an anonymous donor. This is the first year that the contest has been offered. Fogg says that winners will be chosen by a panel of Native judges who are considered leaders in their communities.
The judges rank their favorite sort of ideas, and then we go through and tabulate those, and you know, sort of the ones that continue to be the favorites over and over again rise to the top, and those end up being the winners.
All essays are due by September 15th. The winners will be announced in October. And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at aprn.org. We had reports tonight from Ed Schoenfeld in Juneau, Casey Kelly in Homer, Emily Schwing and Shalice Haas in Sitka, and Deanna Garrison in Ketchikan. We also had help from Susie Ehrlich and Pierre Lone Wolf in Kotzebue. APRN's Libby Casey reported from Washington, D.C., and Susanna Caldwell from Anchorage. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineers are Gooseberry Peter and Dave Waldron. And I'm Laurie Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company, and by First National Bank Alaska, working shoulder to shoulder with Alaskan businesses for nearly a century. Member FDIC, equal housing lender. The U.S. Bankruptcy Court for the District of Oregon has set a deadline for filing claims for anyone who suffered injury by sexual, mental, or physical abuse or misconduct by a Jesuit priest or others claiming the Society of Jesus, Oregon Providence, has some responsibility. The deadline is November 30th, 2009. Proof of claim forms are available online or by calling 1-888-909-0100. This message is sponsored by the Society of Jesus, Oregon Providence.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.